the pleasure of introducing our first speaker, Andreas Edwards. He is the author of the book that 2 Unit and some of 5 Unit is reading. He's an educator, media designer, and environmental systems consultant with 15 years of experience on numerous sustainability topics. He's the founder and president of EdTrax, and it's a firm specializing in education programs focusing on sustainability. So we have the pleasure of having our author of the book, so please give him a warm welcome to me.
Hello, thank you all for coming. It's great to be here. Thanks to Marcia Winslade and the whole team at the ESLP. This evening, what I'd like to do is go over some of the key points in my research, which is in this book that I guess some of you have and will be reading. And that this book actually grew out of my own master's work. It was my master's thesis originally at New College of California in Santa Rosa. And the question came up to me as I was trying to figure out what my thesis was going to be was, I kept running across all these principles. These principles came out of declarations, they came out of conferences, they came out of authors, organizations. And I realized that in many ways, these principles were key to understanding the overall conversation related to sustainability. So by looking at these principles, I figured here's a way to try and get a grasp, try and get a container on what this global conversation on sustainability is all about. So as we dive into the issues and the key themes that I discovered, I'd like to start off with the current situation and what we have going. Of course, we all know the world population projections are right now a little over 6 billion, projected to level off at sometime somewhere between 9 to 10, 11 billion people. And when you look at population and GDP, we realize that in the developed countries, population tends to go down. But in the developing countries, it tends to go up. And yet we know that some of the key ways to try and control population has to do with education. It's education for women in developing countries and in other areas. We also see here population growth in the different biomes. And these graphs and a lot of the charts that I'll be showing you come out of the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which is a great resource to begin to understand the global impacts of that we're going through. And that's all online as well. And then when we look at species loss, we realize the dramatic surge in that, and the estimates are 27,000 species lost every year. And again, sharp rise. Recently, carbon dioxide emissions, we all know about this, we all hear about this, most of it caused by our own technology, and again, rising dramatically. There was a great article, because in many of these issues, I think there's a science behind the issue, and then there's how do we get these issues for people who are day-to-day living, busy with their lives, how do we get them interested in it, how do we get them to understand it? Well, a lot of these issues, one way is to get them to, I think, is to relate to stories rather than data. Because data and science is very powerful and it backs us up, but it's really the stories behind it. There was a story in the New Yorker magazine called The Climate of Man. I don't know if maybe some of you are familiar. It was a three-part series, and it really started looking at touring different parts of the world up in the polar regions, in Alaska, and in Greenland and in other places to look at the impact of climate change on those communities. And again, it's the stories that stuck with me and I think will have a great impact on all of us. Again, temperature rising. This is just up to 2000. We know that 2005 was probably the hottest year on record. Al Gore is coming out with a new documentary film about this that is getting some press. It's soon to come out, and I think, again, he's really trying to make this issue very, very visible. It's a very encouraging news. And again, through visuals and through stories. And if any of you read his book years ago when it came out, he also started with stories. He started telling vignettes of different parts in the world and the impact that was having there. So when we look at climate change, here we see the impact on floods. and the dramatic surge in floods in different parts of the world. Again, graphically captivating what impact that has. When we look at wildfires, similar, tremendous rise in wildfires in North America for sure, in Europe, in Africa, and Asia. Again, the droughts and the impact on the wildfires and that. So part of where we're at right now is the huge transformation. I really think it's being precipitated by the energy crisis that we're confronting. And similar thing happened in the early 70s. I remember as a, early 12, 13 years old when that happened. And remembering the gas lines and remembering the whole oil embargo thing. And then we sort of forgot about it. And it was Jimmy Carter who actually did put solar panels on the White House, but then subsequently they were taken down. But again, how do we raise the consciousness? Now it's facing us again, many years later, and we realize how dependent we are on fossil fuels and how we need to make that transition. And the question is, the transition will inevitably happen. The question really is, how smooth will that transition be? And how do we get ahead of it? Richard Heimberg, of course, has written a lot about peak oil, and here we see the famous Hubbert's curve in terms of the peak oil for the U.S. It was in 1970, and whether we reached it a few years ago, or whether we're on it now, or whether we reach it a few years from now in terms of peak oil, the real issue is we need to move into the transition. How will that transition happen? And it's not that we're going to run out of oil. It's that we're going to run out of cheap oil. And we're seeing it already with gas being at over $3 a gallon. Of course, the Europeans are paying $5, $6, $7 a gallon, but we're just getting a taste of that change. And again, in terms of fossil fuel, we always saw natural gas as almost a transition fuel to get us into renewables. But we're finding out that maybe the supplies aren't quite there and that we're going through the natural gas, and we also have to build the infrastructure for the natural gas in this country, which is a huge undertaking as well. And carbon dioxide concentrations, again, that dramatic rise. The other key issue that I think is really important to take into consideration when we look at the global issues is the growth. And primarily here, I want to focus on China and on India, because those two nations are really, their economies are developing at a very, very rapid rate. China has had a 7, 8, 9% growth rate for the last 15, 20 or more years. And what will the world be like if every Chinese has a refrigerator and a car? How will we sustain that? And same thing with India. And how will that change our own economic system? And it's not just the energy issue, but it's also the food associated with it. And the pollution. This was a shot taken by a satellite image of nitrogen dioxide pollution over Beijing. You can see there in the upper part of it. China, for the first time a couple years ago, became a net importer of food. And that's the first time ever. And so we have the bread baskets in the world, the U.S. and Canada. And with that surplus went to China. Well, what happens when China begins to need more of that food, and when we have a year where our yields are not as high as they have been? How do we compensate for that? How do we compensate for the fact that how many barges will be required to take all that food over to China? And China has had historical experience with famines. So they're very, very sensitive to the whole issue of feeding their people, because they have the history of famine. But again, how will we sustain and be able to produce the bumper crops that we have in the past? And that relates to farming, it relates to water, it relates to climate change. All of these issues are interconnected. And if there's one theme that I think is key in understanding ecology and understanding sustainability, is that it's not necessarily about the individual parts, but it's really about the relationships of all the parts and how they play together. And that's really, and we're not taught that way in school. You know, you're an English major, you're journalism, you're biology, whatever it is you are. It's really about the integration, and this is a new way of looking at the world. And what's wonderful about this class, of course, is that it's teaching us to do that. So when we look at sustainability, I have three definitions here. One is the famous one from the Brundtland Commission in the late 80s. The middle one is from Bill McDonough, a green architect, which is a lovely one because it's short and to the point. And the one on the bottom there is my own. And if there's a theme here in all of these, it's really looking at future generations and looking at the interconnections. And that this whole notion of what we leave our kids and our grandkids, you know, that phrase never really meant a whole lot to me until I had my own kids. But it's an essential point. We were talking at dinner tonight about, okay, well, what does this generation think about the problems we're facing? But what will our kids face? And, you know, they're going to grow up in a world where oil is not going to be cheap. We're going to be in the midst of the transition, hopefully moving towards it. Population will be dramatically increased. So what do we leave them? And how can we prepare the world and ourselves and the training in educational institutions like Santa Cruz to be able to go out there and make the changes that are needed? This is, in my own work, I started looking at other social transformations. And I looked at the Industrial Revolution in Britain. And here's a map that shows the industrialization of Great Britain. And you see the concentration of the urbanization really in Great Britain. And in looking at social transformations, I looked at the key aspects of it in the Industrial Revolution and what I call the Sustainability Revolution. So first we start with the genesis. And of course it had to do with taking the precious metals from the New World and Britain establishing a money economy. And in the Sustainability Revolution, it really came down to a key conference that happened in 1972, the UN Human Environment Conference in Sweden. And that conference came about because they had to deal with the issue of pollution. And this is way before the EU was even established, but they realized that these issues were transnational. They did not respect boundaries, so they had to get together as a union. They had to get together as a whole continent to deal with it. And again, in 1987, we had the Brundtland Report, which really started looking at the three E's of sustainability, right? Economy, ecology, and equity. Then we are at the critical mass period. And for the Industrial Revolution, it dealt with some key technological breakthroughs, including the steam engine, the power loom, and the cotton gin. And for the sustainability, it was the Earth Summit in 1992. Which brought together 187 world leaders in Rio, and finally we started looking at these issues on a global scale. And in the 90s and now, and I think that the advent of certain technologies like the internet is having a huge impact in connecting people. But as we talked at dinner tonight, it's not so much the lack of information, but it's really figuring out how to apply that information. You know, Google is great in terms of getting sources out there, but how do we siphon it? How do we figure out what's relevant and what's not? And I think some of that comes down to individuals. When I wrote my book and I was researching it, yes, I could get a lot of information from the web and other sources, but it turned out to for me to contact some key people over in Europe and other places via email and say, you know, I'm really looking at this area in this book. Can you tell me what was your role in it and what's your take on it? And the wonders of email is, yes, it's really easy, and then you hear back and you get a connection with somebody who's a leader in that particular field. So I would encourage all of you, if you're interested in any specific area, it's not that hard to be able to contact the key person there and send them an email and ask, you know, just say, where can I get this? What are your thoughts on this? And lo and behold, most times you will get a response, and that's the beauty of the web. In terms of diffusion, of course, in the Industrial Revolution, it went from Great Britain, then to Europe and America and beyond. And in sustainability, it's from the USA and Europe and to beyond. Now, I'm not so sure that we really reached the critical mass. I mean, there's certain hot spots here in sustainability, in the Bay Area and in Boston and in Austin, Texas, and in Portland and in Seattle, communities that are doing a lot of this work. Peoria, Illinois, the Middle America, in some ways, yeah, but, you know, Latin America, it varies. So, but that's always the way with change. You have some areas that really start taking off and others that catch on. With the advent of technology, again, with the web, we are able to spread the message much further. So I think there's hope in trying to get the word out faster than that. Now, in nonviolence, we had Mahatma Gandhi, and he was a great leader for the whole nonviolence movement. In civil rights, of course, Martin Luther King could be pointed to as a key leader in that movement. But in sustainability, it's grassroots. It's all of us. It's all of us. It's the citizens. There's no central dominating figure that is leading this movement. It's individuals. And that, I believe, is the greatest strength that we have, because it's not hierarchical. Now, some bright spots in terms of just trends that I see in transportation. America has a particular challenge because we're so spread out, and we really have built up this infrastructure that's built on the highway system. So it's really, really challenging for us. We're not as concentrated. We don't have the history that Europe does, for example, or the concentration. But yet we see that when we come up with technologies like in hybrid cars, and even in bicycles, which is a surprising statistic, how the world bicycle production has risen dramatically. In the world, you keep hearing of China going away from bicycles, but in other parts, there's a whole movement to reestablish the bicycle and bike paths, and there's federal grants now, one in Marin County, for example, which is going to establish and get people to start using their bikes in conjunction with mass transit. So you take the bus, you put your bicycle on the bus, and then you bike ride. For example, for college campuses, you can take the bus to the campus, and then you can keep your bike on the campus itself, and then take the bus back. And in Europe, they've done this for years, and in Holland and other places. Wind is a really promising energy source in that it's now competitive with fossil fuels. And again, this is a technology that we sort of spearheaded in the 70s here in the U.S., and then it's the Europeans, particularly Denmark and other countries, that have really taken off with wind. Similar story with solar, again, here in the 70s, and now Germany and Japan. Japan is the number one producer of solar panels right now in the world. And it's Germany that is really, I mean, there's actually a shortage of solar panels here in this country because Germany and Japan and other countries are using them up. And so there's a big incentive to produce more of them. And the incentives that we have here in California are really good in terms of the rebates from the state and even countywide rebates as well. Food. We see organic foods, and I was hearing more about at dinner tonight about the great efforts you're doing here on this campus in terms of organic foods, and that's a great, great example. Again, the whole farmers market, community-supported agriculture programs that are taking place. Green building, which is an area that I've done a lot of work in the last several years in terms of education related to green building. There's a U.S. Green Building Council, which is the fastest growing nonprofit in the country. And they have established a template called the LEED, which stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And it really has different areas where you look at sustainable sites, you look at water, you look at energy, you look at indoor environmental quality, materials and resources, all these different aspects related to green building. And then you rate it. And you have the platinum, the gold, the silver, and the certified levels. And, you know, I sort of do wish they have picked sequoias and redwoods and other trees as, instead of metals. But the idea of a competitive system that encourages people to rise to the next level is really good. And it's really a baseline. LEED is just the baseline. There's so much more that can be done. But it's provided a standard for all of the builders, and it's transforming the whole building industry. And it's not just here in the U.S., but there's a World Green Building Council now, which is a worldwide organization. That has 13 countries now that are members of it. So it's taken off in the U.S. and abroad. The graduation pledge is a pledge that was started by a school in the Midwest in terms of looking at students who graduate from schools such as this and saying, you know, what is our future? What is our criteria in terms of working for socially responsible businesses? And can we have a pledge? And it's the big schools, Harvard and Duke and Yale and I think UCLA and other schools have sort of signed on to this, but also some very small schools are signing on, and hopefully UC Santa Cruz will be a part of that soon too. So in looking at the principles, I came up with probably 40 or 50 of them and had to, I mean, there were hundreds out there and there's more now. But started looking at it and then breaking them down into when they came about. And it's hard to say specifically when they came about, but really looking at that. And then what their scope is, because I wanted to get a real cross-section of the scope from the regional to the national to the international to the local ones. And then what sector they came out of. Was it a government sector? Was it a multi-stake sector? And then the type. And the typology really relates to the values and metrics. You have something like the Earth Charter, for example, which is very values-oriented, as a UN charter on sustainability that came out. And then you have something like LEED that has metrics, some real metrics which help all of us kind of implement the guiding principles. And the ones that are really taking off out there are the ones that have both the values and the metrics. Like the Forest Stewardship Council, which is for sustainably harvested wood, like LEED, like ICLEI, which I'll talk about a little later, which have the set principles and then, how do we implement these principles? What are the metrics in how we're going to measure them and how we're going to know that they're successful? So some of the key themes that have come out of all these principles, the first one is stewardship. And this really speaks to an ecological ethic. Aldo Leopold wrote extensively about this. But what is our role with the natural world? Yes, we are part of the natural world. We are a species. But what is our role within it? What is the ethic, the ethos that we bring to it? It's a key aspect of it. Second one is respect for limits. You know, we talk about how many worlds we need, and the work of Matthias Wackernagel and the Global Footprint Network talks about how we really exceeded the biocapacity right now of the Earth years ago. So we're really in overshoot mode right now in terms of resources. So how do we understand the respect for limits? Here's a key case in point about the collapse of the Atlantic cod fisheries. This has been written about extensively in terms of how we basically overfished it, and it reached its peak and then it just dropped and it has never recovered. And that's just one fisheries, and you could say that about many other species. Okay. Sure. Interdependence. Interdependence really is looking at the ecosystem services. How do we begin to value what nature does for free? What nature is doing all of the time for us? You talk about water filtering, pollination, soil fertilization, pest control. These are things that nature is doing all the time. And Gretchen Daly down at Stanford is doing a lot of work on this area. And so Robert Costanza, who is an ecological economist, tried to put a dollar figure on this. And they came up with $33 trillion, which is the combined gross domestic product of the whole world. So it's hard to try and put a dollar on life, on the life support systems. But since our world is so dominated by economics, it's a way for us to begin to understand the impact of what nature does for free. The photo there that you see is the Biosphere Project, which was in Arizona years ago, which was an attempt to try and duplicate and recreate biomes and ecosystems. And they had the 7 or 8 biospherians that were called that lived there and tried to live there, but it failed. There was a leak. The oxygen got in. They had mangroves, they had coral reefs, they had all kinds of biomes there. And we were not able to do it. I commend the idea of trying to see what we can do with technology, but nature is doing this already. And you know what? It's hard to compete with nature, who has 3.8 billion years of experience. We are the newbies here. We are the babies. You know, we're just beginning to learn. And rather than try and recreate it, maybe we could do a better job in terms of protecting the ecosystems. In New York City, they looked at, they needed to build a water treatment plant for Manhattan. And they looked at the cost of building this power plant. And then they realized that if they get their water from the Catskills in upstate New York, what would it cost to protect the biosystem there? What would it cost to protect the watershed in the Catskills? And they realized that it's a hell of a lot cheaper to do that, and it's much more efficient to do that than to try and find a solution, a technological solution. Similar things can be said about desalinization plants, which is, yes, a technology where we can get fresh water out of salt water, but are there other ways in terms of conservation, in terms of irrigation, in terms of water use that we can start implementing? Again, learning from nature and what we can learn from nature. Economic restructuring. This is a complex chart here, but it's really looking at the three E's of sustainability and integrating the social with the natural with the economic and understanding the linkages that I spoke about earlier. And I think that's a real challenge because often we don't see it right off the bat. But when we think about green building, for example, we think about the site, we think about water, we think about food. When we think about water, we should also think about energy. Well, what's the connection between water and energy? Well, it takes a lot of energy to pump water places. So by conserving water, in a way, we're able to reduce the infrastructure necessary, thereby conserving energy of moving the water. This is from a pattern language, which is a great website. Stuart Cowan has been working on this in trying to create a map of a new economic model. Fair distribution, again, the per capita distribution of wealth in the world and resources, and a real challenge in how this is going to be achieved, the fact that in the U.S. and in the developed world, we're gobbling up most of the resources to just maintain the lifestyle that we have. And again, this really speaks to the whole notion of consumption. An intergenerational perspective is what I spoke about earlier. How do we change our economic model from a quarterly basis in terms of return on investment and what where a whole business cycles are about, more to a 10, 20, 100, 500, 1,000 year plan? How do we do that? You know, the seven generations of Native Americans, how do we move forward in thinking about that? Picture on the left is from the Long Now Foundation. It's a 10,000 year clock. And this is a model of a 10,000 year clock that's in the museum in London. And they are actually going to build this clock, big scale, in Nevada. And it's a way to begin to think long term. And this Long Now Foundation is all about thinking long term. The one on the right is an etched piece where they're going to etch in, it's called the Rosetta Project. And they're etching in all of the languages of the world because we're losing languages at an extremely fast rate. And the people that are speaking these languages are dying off and it's not being passed on. So they figured, in what kind of technology can we use to begin to etch these languages so we don't lose them? There's the old story in Easter Island where much of their history and their language and their culture was carved in these tablets. And when the Westerners arrived there, these tablets, they were used for firewood, right? Because they didn't know any better. And I think to this day, there's only one or two tablets left in the world that really tells the whole story of the Eastern Islanders. One of them is in London. So again, how do we preserve? You know, when we think about preservation of species, there's also the cultural preservation, because there's so much to learn from other cultures. And a previous book that I worked on Tibet really speaks about the Tibetan culture as a seed culture because of the wisdom that they've gained over millennia in living in such a harsh environment. What can we learn from that? And nature is model and teacher. This is, again, the work of Janine Benyus in looking at nature as a design model. And a lot of her work really brings to light the importance of having the biologist sit down with the engineer, sit down with the architect, sit down with the businessman, and really, again, what I was talking about earlier, cross-pollinating the expertise and learning from the billions of years of evolutionary experience. Bill McDonough, of course, in his views about eco-effectiveness, how do we not just think about the efficiency of it, but the effectiveness of it in terms of what also works for us as humans, you know, in buildings. We could have the most efficient building in the world with no windows, and it's efficient, but does it work for us? No. We gravitate towards natural light. We gravitate towards healthy air. We like to be able to open windows. We like to be able to converse with people. We're not made to be in cubicles staring at a monitor all the time. So those are the kinds of issues that the Bill McDonough and others are starting to look at in terms of how we design our built environment. So now some bright lights. These are just some some examples I'll be talking about is some of the projects that some of them I'm involved with, others that are going on there. The first was the U.S. partnership. This is a program from the United Nations. It's a worldwide program. And the U.S. component is called the U.S. Partnership. It's uspartnership.org. And it's part of a decade. They're spending the decade on sustainable education for sustainable development. So the idea is really to mainstream sustainability education from groups like us and other colleges and other small nonprofits that are doing this work. How do we get it out into Time and Newsweek and CNN and all of the major avenues? So I've been part of what the